covering the ventilation shaft. It was 2 feet square.
The same size as the crate I escaped from jail in.
As she climbed onto the toilet seat, then up onto the cistern, tears of pain filled her eyes. Her left calf was in agony. She bit down hard on her lip to stop herself from screaming and reached up with both hands. Dislodging the grate was easy. As she pushed it aside, a shower of dust fell into her eyes, temporarily blinding her, but there was no time to stop and recover. Digging her nails into the ceiling, Grace hauled herself up, squeezing her tiny frame into the ventilation shaft like dough into a pasta maker. Carefully, she replaced the grate behind her. Dust still stung her eyes like acid, but it didn't matter. Ahead of her was nothing but darkness. Inch by inch, she pulled herself forward into the void. Mitch walked into the ladies' room. There were 3 cubicles, all of them empty. He turned to leave, then stopped. Walking into the middle cubicle, he ran his finger across the top of the toilet seat. The dust was as thick as sugar icing. Mitch traced a letter G and looked up. Could a human being fit in there? Back in the corridor, he yelled into his radio.
I need to see plans of the ventilation system, blueprints. Where do those tunnels go?
The chief resident stepped out of the elevator and pointed at Mitch.
There, in the blue shirt!
3 burly security guards rushed towards him. Seconds later, Mitch found himself being manhandled towards the emergency stairs, while the resident looked on, arms folded, smiling with satisfaction.
Talk about a ball buster. For God's sake, I'm a police officer. Do you realize what I could do to you guys for this? Let me go.
The biggest of the guards murmured,
You're kidding, right? Do you realize what she could do to us if we let go of your ass? Trust me, officer, you ain't got no idea.
Grace's vision was clearing. She saw light, faint rays at first, but they gradually got stronger. The tunnel forked left and right. The light was coming from the left. Grace moved towards it.
I swear to God, if we've lost her because of this bullshit, I will personally see to it that they don't let you loose on a patient again with so much as a band-aid.
It had taken 15 minutes for Mitch's boss, Lieutenant Dubray, to fax the necessary warrants and consents to the hospital. Only once she had them in her hands did the chief resident order her heavies to let Mitch out of her office.
Don't try to scare me, detective, she laughed. Haven't you embarrassed yourself enough for one day?
Mitch was about to hit back when one of his subordinates burst in.
Blueprints, he panted, unrolling paper onto the desk.
Grace looked down through the grill. The room was empty. This time it was tougher to wrench the ventilation panel free. Squeezed into the shaft like raw meat in sausage skin, she was having a tough time getting any traction. Finally, with sweat from her efforts pouring down her back and chest, Grace pulled out the grill and eased herself down into the room below. The light was so bright it took a few seconds to get her bearings. She looked around.
I'm in an X-ray room.
She wondered how long it would be before the technician showed up with the next patient.
Do they always leave the lights on, or did someone just step out for a minute?
Voices outside the door answered her question. 2 men were talking. Grace watched their shadows grow larger.
They're coming in.
Mitch studied the blueprints. The ventilation shaft had 9 grills on the 6th floor. Each of them a potential exit.
Mitch dispatched men into each one. The bad news was he'd lost 15 minutes. The good news was that there was no way out of the building, nor could somebody crawl between floors. It was a case of what goes up must come down.
What's the closest exit to that lady's room?
The officer traced the tunnel with his finger.
That would be right here. X-ray and MRI room.
Mitch started running. The grill in the X-ray room ceiling was still hanging open. Grace hadn't bothered to try to cover her tracks. She knows she's running out of time.
I don't understand it, said the technician. I've been here the whole time. I stepped out for literally 30 seconds, but if she got in here while I was gone, she'd have to have come past our reception desk. Lisa would have seen her for sure.
So would my men, said Mitch.
He scratched his head. Is there any other way out of here?
No.
No service elevator? Fire stairs? No window?
No. Look around you, detective. This is it.
Mitch looked around. The technician was right. The room was a smooth box, empty apart from the humming X-ray machine and the circular MRI tube.
Nowhere to run, nowhere to hide.
Then suddenly he saw it. In the corner, a laundry hamper full of used scrubs. Heart pounding, Mitch dived in, pulling out used scrubs like a starving man hunting for food scraps in a dumpster. In seconds, the floor was littered with blue hospital gowns and face masks, but no sign of Grace. He tried to keep the disappointment out of his voice.
Okay, so she must have gone back into the shaft. Where's the next exit?
Grace waited till they'd gone. Then, realizing the locked muscles in her arms and legs where she'd pressed herself flat against the top of the MRI tube, she fell into the body of the machine, bruising her ribs painfully. She'd outwitted Mitch Connors for now. But how much time had that bought her? A minute? Three? Five? Despair washed over her. The whole hospital's surrounded. I'm never gonna get out. She contemplated giving up. Before she knew about Connie and Lenny's betrayal, she'd never questioned why she kept running, why she kept fighting. It was all for Lenny. She had to clear his name, to honor his memory. Now, for the first time, Grace realized that wasn't enough anymore. She needed another, better reason. She needed to fight for herself. She needed to save her own life. Easing herself out of the machine, she stood up. I can't give up. I won't. She picked up a set of scrubs from the pile on the floor and pulled them on. Grace walked slowly toward the fire stairs, trying not to limp.
I have to get off this floor, make it to ground level, and try and bluff my way out of here.
The X-ray department receptionist watched her pass but said nothing. With her blue paper hat pulled low and a surgical mask over her face, she could have been anyone. Beyond reception, two cops stood by the swing doors. Grace waited with her heart in her mouth for one of them to ask her for ID, but they, too, let her pass. She was almost at the emergency exit door. Just a few more paces.
Hey! Hey, you! In the blue!
Grace kept walking.
Hey!
The voice got louder.
Stop!
Keep going. Don't look back.
You can't go out of there. It's...
Grace opened the door.
Alarmed!
Sirens whooped. Bells, shrill and deafening, rang in Grace's ears. For a moment she panicked, frozen. In a few seconds, the stairwell would be crawling with cops.
"I'll never make it down 6 floors. There's no time."
She looked up and started to run. Mitch's radio crackled.
"She's on the east fire stairs, 6th floor.
His heart leapt. "Cover every exit."
"Already done, sir."
"Tell all units you can draw your weapons, but do not fire. Understand? No shooting."
"Sir."
There was no way out of the building. Outside the hospital, the media had already begun to arrive. Mitch knew none of his men would have leaked the story, but it was tough to send 100 cops into a major New York City hospital without people getting curious. TV crews scrambled to set up their equipment, eager to capture the drama as it unfolded. Mitch thought, they're probably hoping for a shootout. How much would the first shots of Grace Brookstein's dead body be worth? He wished he could protect her, that he could stop her from running, keep her safe with him. He headed for the roof. Grace looked around her.
"This is it. The end of the road."
If only Manhattan's skyline were like a Spider-Man movie, where the next building over was always a short jump away. In real life, the 8-story hospital was sandwiched between 2 20-story towers. The only way down from the roof was via the fire stairs Grace had just come up, or an identical set of stairs on the western side of the building. Unless, of course, you jumped. Bolting both sets of fire doors behind her, Grace crawled up on her hands and knees over to the edge of the rooftop, making her way around the perimeter. She peered over the edge of the rooftop. In a movie, there would have been a handy dumpster to break her fall, or a truck full of feather pillows that just happened to have pulled up at a red light. No such luck. She heard the door to the east stairs start rattling. A few seconds later, the other door followed suit.
"They're coming."
Tears filled Grace's eyes. They would catch her. They would send her back to jail. She would never know the truth. In that moment, as the rattling of the doors grew louder, it became clear. She had nothing left to live for. The door burst open, sending the metal bolt clattering. Mitch shot out onto the concrete like a ball from a cannon. He looked up just in time to see a flash of blue disappearing over the edge of the rooftop.
"Grace, no!"
He was too late. Book 3, Chapter 28. Mitch put a hand over his mouth. There was an audible gasp from the crowds gathered below, then screams.
"I've just chased an innocent woman to her death."
Why hadn't Grace waited? If he'd only had a chance to talk to her, to tell her he believed in her, that he knew Lenny hadn't killed himself, that he knew she was innocent, that he was starting to fall in love with her. He couldn't bear to look, yet he knew he had to. Behind him, a stream of cops had filed onto the rooftop, all with guns drawn. Mitch walked forward slowly to the spot where the blue flash had disappeared. Squatting down on his haunches, he took a deep, fortifying breath and looked down, bracing himself for the sight of Grace's bloodied, broken corpse. The sidewalk was empty.
"What the?"
The roof jutted out about 2 feet beyond the outer walls of the hospital building, like stiff white icing spilling over the edge of a wedding cake. Lying on his belly, Mitch reached under the ledge. His fingers grasped at the air. Nothing. He inched farther forward like a snake, till his torso dangled perilously over the edge of the building. The crowd gasped again. Suddenly, Mitch felt a small, cold hand in his. Perched on a window ledge no more than 8 inches wide, Grace looked up into Mitch's eyes and gave him a sad, defeated smile.
"Detective Connors, we must stop meeting like this."
The sensational footage of Grace Brookstein's capture was aired around the globe. Overnight, Mitch Connors of the NYPD went from bumbling cop to national hero. Speculation was rife as to where America's most wanted fugitive was being held. Would Grace be sent back to Bedford Hills, or to a different, secret, more secure location? Would there be another trial? The hunt for Grace Brookstein had cost the U.S. taxpayer millions of dollars. Surely some stiffening of Grace's original sentence was called for. Behind the scenes, an interagency battle raged. Everyone wanted access to Grace. Mitch Connors' view was that possession was 9/10 of the law.
"We've got her, and we're not handing her over to the FBI or anyone else till we're done questioning her."
But the FBI's Harry Bain wasn't the only one on Mitch's case. His own superiors in the police department seemed eager to wash their hands of Grace as soon as possible. Detective Lieutenant Dubray agreed.
"She's not our problem anymore."
Mitch dug his heels in. "I have a right to question her for 48 hours.
"Don't lecture me about your rights, Connors, and don't be so fucking naive. This case is political dynamite, and you know it. Grace Brookstein's a walking embodiment of everything this country's trying to forget. This goes all the way to the top. The president himself has told his advisors that Grace's face on the news is bad for business, bad for jobs, bad for brand America."
"Brand America? Come on, sir."
Mitch fought his corner, but he knew time was running out. Soon Grace would be taken away from him, and his chance to help her would be gone. Whatever other feelings he had, or thought he had, for her, he had to put them aside. All that mattered now was the truth.
"I have to get her to trust me."
Grace studied Mitch's features intently.
"He seems genuine, but then my track record as a judge of character is hardly exemplary."
"So, you're saying you want to help me?"
"Yes, I want to help you. I'm the only one who wants to help you, Grace, but I can't if you don't talk to me."
Grace looked at him skeptically.
"I read Bucola's file," said Mitch. "I believe that Lenny was murdered. I believe that you were both set up, but I need your help to prove it."
"If you know Lenny was murdered, why haven't you reopened the investigation into his death?"
"I tried to. I was blocked. My superiors were more interested in capturing you than in finding out the truth about Quorum or what may have happened on that boat."
"But you're different? That's what you want me to believe, right? That you're a lone warrior for truth?"
"Look, I don't blame you for distrusting me, but I don't have time to convince you. In a few hours, the powers that be are gonna take you away from here. We may never get another opportunity to speak to each other. This is our last chance, your last chance. Tell me what you know."
"What I know?"
Grace laughed bitterly.
I don't know anything. Everything I thought I knew turned out to be a lie. I thought I was rich, but it turned out I had nothing. I thought the courts would protect the innocent, but they sent me to jail. I thought my friends and family loved me, but they were nothing but a pack of vultures. I thought Lenny died in an accident. I thought he was a faithful husband. I thought he loved me.
Tears rolled down her cheeks. Without thinking, Mitch walked around the interview table and put his arms around her. She was so tiny, so vulnerable. He was overwhelmed with an urge to protect her, to rescue her.
"I'm sure Lenny loved you,"
he whispered, stroking her newly shorn white blonde hair.
"People have affairs. They're weak. They make mistakes."
He told her how close he'd come to catching her at Jasmine Delavine's apartment.
"Was that why you tried to kill yourself, because of Connie and Lenny?"
"No," Grace said hotly. "And I didn't try to kill myself. I..."
She broke off. She wanted to tell him about the abortion, about the rape, about all of it, but she didn't have the words.
Mitch said, "He broke it off with Connie, you know, before he died. Your sister was blackmailing Lenny, threatening him to tell you about the affair. He'd already paid $15 million into an offshore account for her, but Connie was squeezing him for more."
"Was she? How do you know?"
"She told me herself. Bragged about it, if you must know. The point is, Lenny was desperate not to hurt you, Grace. Not to lose you. He regretted what happened, I'm sure of it."
Grace closed her eyes and succumbed to the comfort of Mitch's arms around her. It had been so long since she had intimate contact with another human being, so long since she'd felt kindness, warmth, affection.
"That's all this is," she told herself firmly. "Affection. A moment's break in the battle."
In another life, another world, things might have been different. As it was, there was a knock on the door.
"Sorry, boss."
The officer was hesitant. He liked Mitch, and he hated being the bearer of bad news.
"Dubray says you got 5 minutes. We got orders direct from Washington. The prisoner's being transferred out of state."
When he'd gone, Mitch clasped Grace's hands. There was a connection between them. He could see she felt it, too.
"Talk to me."
Grace told him everything she knew. When she was done, Mitch said,
"You realize who's left, don't you? If Andrew Preston and Jack Warner and your sister Connie are all innocent..."
Grace sighed.
"John Merrill, but it wasn't him."
"You sound very sure."
"I suspected John from the beginning. I know he set me up at my trial, and who knows, maybe he took that money. But he couldn't have killed Lenny."
"Why not?"
"He was in Boston the day Lenny took the boat out. Davy checked out his alibi months ago."
"Yes, so did I."
Mitch looked thoughtful. He remembered his lunch with John Merrill, the way his speech impediment had magically disappeared when he spoke about the day Lenny Brookstein disappeared.
"Still, there's something not right about that man."
Grace stared blankly at the door. Mitch thought,
"She doesn't care anymore. She's given up."
When she spoke, there was neither fear nor curiosity in her voice.
"Do you know where they're taking me?"
"No, but I'll find out."
Once again, Mitch found himself gripped with the urge to rescue her. What was it about this woman that brought out his inner knight in shining armor?
"I'll do my best to help you, Grace. Get you a decent lawyer, begin an appeal."
I don't want any of that.
But you have to.
She looked him in the eye.
If you want to help me, find out who murdered my husband. I don't think you'll ever be able to clear his name of the quorum fraud, but I'd like people to know Lenny wasn't a coward, that he didn't kill himself.
I'll try. But, Grace, even if I succeed, Lenny's dead. You're alive. You have your whole life ahead of you. You must get a new lawyer. You must appeal.
The officer reappeared, along with two more armed officers and a dour-faced man in a suit.
CIA? FBI?
Time to go.
Grace stood up. Impulsively, she kissed Mitch on the cheek.
Forget about me.
Mitch watched the men take her away. After she'd gone, he stood in the empty interview room for a long time.
Forget about you. If only I could.
Chapter 29. Maria Preston tossed back her long mane of chestnut hair and admired her reflection in the rearview mirror. She had the skin of a woman 10 years younger, and she knew it. This afternoon, her creamy white complexion was flushed and glowing, a testament to the 3 hours she'd just spent in bed with her lover. What a joy it was to be with a man who appreciated her! Maria had been with scores of men, many of them more technically proficient at lovemaking than her current paramour, and almost all of them more physically attractive. But woman could not live on 6-pack abs alone. There came a point in her life where she needed more. Power. Maria Preston's lover was a powerful man, a man of influence, not like Andrew. Poor Andy, he wasn't a bad husband. In the last couple of years, he'd finally started making the sort of money that he could give Maria the lifestyle she deserved. Wealth was one thing she'd thought she wanted all these years, but now that she finally had it, it bored her. He bored her. Sexually, intellectually, and every other way. She realized now that however much money Andrew had made, he would always be an accountant. And as long as she stayed with him, she would always be an accountant's wife. Maria Carmine, an accountant's wife. The very idea was preposterous, an affront to nature. The only wonder was that it had taken her so long to see it. A free spirit like Maria should not be trapped into such a banal marriage, like lesser mortals. It was like trying to freeze a volcano or to flood a desert. Applying a fresh slick of bright red Dior lipstick, Maria reflected on her destiny.
I was born to be a great man's wife, his muse.
Now, at last, she would be. She'd finally figured it out, a way for her lover to leave his wife, to be free of all the pressures weighing him down, and to run away with her. Maria, in her brilliance, has solved all their problems. She would leave Andrew and start afresh. Her lover had been overjoyed when she told him the plan last week. He'd still been excited about it when they met today, making love to her with a passionate intensity unusual even for him. Maria smiled at her reflection in the rearview mirror and laughed.
You're not just a pretty face.
She was on her way back to the city from Sag Harbor. It was a schlep to get out there. 2 hours on a good day, 3 in rush hour. But Maria's lover couldn't risk being seen with her in Manhattan, and besides, the American Hotel on Main Street was so quaint and charming with its white portico and cheery, striped awning, it was worth the trip. Turning onto Scuttle Hole Road, Maria noticed Nancy's Cake Shop up ahead, one of her favorite haunts, its window display enticingly crammed with cupcakes of every color and flavor. All that sex had given her quite an appetite. Why not? She pulled over and turned off the engine, humming happily to herself as she opened the driver's side door. Nancy Robertson was out back in the kitchen when she heard the explosion. Her heart racing, she ran into the store. Thank God no one was in there. The room was destroyed. Every window was shattered, shards of glass mingling with the buttercream icing stuck onto the walls. Outside on the street, all that was left of Maria Preston's Bentley was a twisted hulk of burning metal. Mitch Connors was at the playground with his daughter. It was the first Saturday he hadn't worked in months. Helen was reluctant to let him have Celeste.
You can't just swan in and out of her life when it suits you, Mitch. Do you have any idea how disappointed she was when you didn't show up for her school play? You couldn't have been bothered to call and explain?
Guilt made Mitch lash out. Explain what? I'm working, Helen. I'm paying for that roof over both your heads. Besides, I'm not asking your permission to see her. It's my weekend.
Now, watching Celeste kick her skinny legs as he pushed her on the swing, he regretted losing his temper. He wasn't in love with Helen anymore, but there was no denying she was a great mom. He, on the other hand, was a lousy father. He liked to tell himself that he spent quality time with his daughter, but he knew it was a crock. Mitch loved Celeste, but the truth was he barely knew her. Even now, when he hadn't seen her for weeks, he couldn't switch off work. His thoughts kept drifting back to Grace Brookstein, where she was being held and how on earth he was going to keep his promise to her. No one wanted to know about his theories of foul play in Lenny Brookstein's death. 2 days ago, Dubray spelled it out for him in black and white.
Let it go, Mitch. You're a good detective, but you've gotten way too personally involved on this one. Besides, I've got a new case for you. Teen homicide, junkie, no leads. Right up your alley.
Can you give it to someone else? All I need is a little more time to look into this stuff, a few weeks at most.
No, I can't give it to someone else. You don't get to choose your assignments, Mitch. You are on the Brady homicide as of right now, and if I catch you wasting one more minute of department time on this Brookstein bullshit, believe me, I will have you suspended so fast you won't know what hit you. I won't tell you again. Drop it.
Drop it. Forget about me.
Maybe next someone would tell him to stop exhaling carbon dioxide or sleeping with his eyes shut. His cell phone rang. It was Carl, a buddy from work.
You anywhere near a TV man?
No. Why?
There's been a car bombing in Long Island. Looks like a mafia job. The victim's the wife of one of those Quorum guys you keep talking about. Preston.
Mitch stopped pushing the swing.
Maria Preston?
Daddy! Higher!
She's dead?
Very dead. Nothing left of her, apparently.
Daddy!
You gotta watch this, man. It's all over the news.
Mitch hung up and started running to his car. He had to get to a TV. A woman ran after him.
Sir? Excuse me, sir?
Mitch turned around. The woman pointed to Celeste, sitting forlornly on the stationary swing. Mitch had forgotten all about her. John Merrivale was late. He hated being late. Hurrying into his office, he sat down and started pulling open drawers, looking for papers while his computer fired up.
You all right, John?
Harry Bain put his head around the door.
Fine, thank you.
Sorry I'm late in this morning. The press keep badgering me for a statement about Maria Preston.
Poor woman. Terrible thing. You expect car bombs in Beirut or Gaza, but not in Sag Harbor. She was a friend of yours, wasn't she?
John looked irritated.
No, not really. Her husband was a colleague, but the media hear the word quorum, and I'm their first call. I wish to God they'd leave me be.
Harry Bain frowned. It seemed an oddly detached, clinical response to such an awful tragedy. But then he never had figured out John Merrivale. He let it go.
Are you still all set for Mystique?
Of course.
The task force had discovered that one of Lenny's family trusts, Brookstein's dependents in Guernsey, had made a number of payments to a financier called Jacob Rees. The FBI was interested in what had become of that money, but so far Mr. Rees's business managers in New York had been less than cooperative. John Merrivale was planning a surprise visit to the great man's Mystique estate. Jake Rees's mansion was less than a mile down the beach from Lenny's own, now seized, compound, and the two men had once vacationed together.
I guess if you have to spend years of your life chasing a money trial, there are worse places to go, right?
John forced a smile.
I suppose there are.
How long do you think you'll be gone?
A day or so, I hope. It may take longer if Jake's not immediately receptive.
Well, if you need any help, you know where I am. Harry Bain walked back into his own office. John Merrivale breathed a sigh of relief.
You're in the home stretch now, John. The hard part is over.
It was all coming together at last. Grace was back behind bars. Whispers had already started around the office that the Bureau was growing tired of throwing good money after bad, and that Harry Bain's Quorum Task Force might soon be quietly disbanded. John had suffered a terrible moment of panic last week when the prospect of exposure had suddenly loomed from a most unexpected quarter. But now that, too, was over. In a few days, he'd be on an airplane.
At last.
The Maria Preston murder case had been given to an old rival of Mitch's from his own precinct, an overweight family man in his 50s named Donald Falk. With his tonsure of white hair, his big belly, and full salt-and-pepper beard, Detective Falk's nickname on the force was Santa. Not that Don's cases called for much ho-ho-hoing. An NYPD lifer, Don Falk specialized in mob killings. He told Mitch,
"The media's getting folks all stirred up about terrorism. It's bullshit. If this was a terror attack, I'm Dolly Parton. This wasn't Al-Qaeda. It was Al Capone. It's got mafia written all over it."
"What makes you so sure?"
Don Falk's eyes narrowed.
"Experience. What makes you so interested? This ain't your case, Connors."
"What if it wasn't a mob hit? What if Maria Preston knew something? Something about Quorum, maybe. Something important enough to make someone want to kill her?"
"We looked into all that," said Don dismissively. "This had nothing to do with Quorum, okay? Definitively. Someone didn't kill her. This was a sophisticated car bomb, not a knife or a gun."
"It's a classic Casa Nostra M.O. Do you know who invented the car bomb, Don?"
Falk rolled his eyes.
"I don't got time for a history lesson, Connors. I have a murder to solve. Now, if you'll excuse me..."
"It was a guy named Buddha. Mario Buddha. He was an Italian anarchist back in 1920.
"What did I tell you? Italian.
It was a hot day in September.
Jesus, Mitch!
This guy, Buddha, parks his horse and wagon on the corner of Wall Street and Broad, across the street from J.P. Morgan's offices. He gets out and wanders into the crowd. 12 o'clock. All the bankers are heading out for lunch, right? You can hear the bells of Trinity Church ringing.
Very poetic.
Then, boom. The horse and cart are blown to bits. It's mayhem. Dead bodies everywhere. Rubble, shrapnel. Right on Wall Street. 1920. 200 people were wounded. 40 killed. Not including old J.P. himself, I might add. He was the intended target, but he was in Scotland at the time.
Don Falk had humored him long enough.
Where are you going with this, Mitch?
The car bomb was invented by one lone, ignorant immigrant with a grudge against rich Wall Street bankers.
So?
So, it was 100-odd years ago, but the principle's the same. Why does this have to be mafia? Any idiot with some grudge could have strapped some Semtex to that car. Some Fruit Loop might have linked Maria in his addled brain with Quorum or Lenny Brookstein.
Don Falk laughed.
Dubray's right. You are obsessed. This guy doesn't have a fucking thing to do with Lenny Brookstein, okay? I think you need to go and lie down.
I want to interview Andrew Preston.
Donald Falk finally lost his temper.
Over my dead body. Now you listen to me, Connor. Stay the fuck away from my case. I'm serious.
Why, Don? Are you worried I might uncover something inconvenient?
If I hear you've been within 10 miles of Andrew Preston, I'm going to Dubray and he is going to fire your ass. Drop it.
Drop it.
Mitch was starting to feel like a naughty Labrador retriever with his jaws around some other dog's stick. He left Donald Falk's office and walked straight to his car. It had been a month since Mitch last visited the Preston's Midtown apartment. He remembered it as an expensive piece of real estate, an enormous 5-bedroom pad in a tony, well-maintained building. But what had struck him most about it was how little it struck him. Everything about Andrew and Maria's home was bland. From the nondescript street outside to the dutifully tasteful cream and brown decor inside. Mitch couldn't imagine having that much money to spend and wasting it on something so safe. Maria Preston had been an irritating woman. Mitch loathed drama queens, but at least she had some color to her, some life. She must have felt entombed in that apartment, as if she'd been cut and pasted into a page from the Pottery Barn catalog, laminated for all eternity onto a cream B&B Italia sofa, and left there to rot. Turning onto the Preston's block, Mitch slowed. Uniformed beat cops were in the process of having the street cordoned off. Mitch pulled up at the same time as 2 ambulances and a fleet of squad cars.
"What's with the circus? What's going on?"
He flashed his badge.
"It's Maria Preston's husband, sir." "What about him?"
"Looks like he hanged himself, sir, about an hour ago. They're cutting him down now."
Chapter 30. Upstairs, paramedics leaned over Andrew Preston's body, pumping his chest. Mitch could tell instantly that it was hopeless. They were just going through the motions.
"Crime scene guys got here yet?"
One of the medics shook his head.
"You are the first. Detective Falk is on his way."
"Any note?"
"Yeah, through there."
The medic gestured toward the living room. The window was open. On the tasteful oak coffee table between the two tasteful beige suede armchairs, a piece of paper fluttered in the breeze, pinned down by a heavy glass ashtray. Without bothering to put on gloves, Mitch moved the ashtray and picked it up. In neat, cursive handwriting, Andrew Preston had written 7 words. It was my fault. Forgive me, Maria.
What the fuck are you doing?
Mitch jumped, dropping the note.
Detective Lieutenant Dubray's voice boomed off the walls like an angry giant's.
Are you out of your mind?
Mitch opened his mouth to explain himself, then closed it again. What could he say? He knew he shouldn't be here. Still, less should he be messing with another detective's crime scene. Dubray was incandescent with rage.
That's evidence tampering. Do you understand how serious that is? I could have you thrown off the force. I should have you thrown off the force.
I'm sorry. I needed to talk to Andrew Preston.
You're a little late for that.
Yeah, so I see. Look, sir, I would have waited for Falk, but I knew he'd be obstructive. He probably wouldn't even have let me see the note.
Of course he wouldn't. And why the fuck should he? This is not your case, Mitch.
But, sir, he's not even asking the obvious questions, like, what was Maria Preston doing in Sag Harbor anyway, and who knew she was gonna be there?
Don called me half an hour ago. He told me you were poking your nose in, rambling about Lenny goddamn Brookstein. He thinks you've lost it.
Oh, come on, sir. You know Don Falk's always had it in for me.
I think you've lost it, too. I'm sorry, Mitch, but you've gone too far this time. You're on suspension until further notice.
Sir.
Consider yourself on indefinite leave until you hear from me otherwise, and don't look so goddamn hard done by. You're lucky you aren't fired. If I didn't know how much Helen and Celeste count on that paycheck, I wouldn't think twice. Now get out of here before I change my mind.
On his way home, Mitch passed the bar where he'd first met with Davy Bucola. He went inside and ordered a scotch.
Keep him coming, he told the barman. Bad day?
Mitch shrugged. Bad year. Bad life.
Part of him wished he'd never laid eyes on Davy Bucola. If it hadn't been for Davy's ferret-like digging into Lenny Brookstein's death, none of this would have happened. Mitch would have arrested Grace and been done with it. Moved on to the next case like everyone wanted him to. Maybe even made captain. Instead, here he was, alone, suspended from duty, all because of Bucola's file and the promise he'd made Grace.
Grace. Mitch wondered again where she was. No one would tell him anything. He imagined her being interrogated, locked in solitary confinement, sleep-deprived. He thought about her sad eyes, her courage, her surprising sense of humor, even in the direst of situations, and hoped her spirit hadn't already been broken. Through the whiskey haze, Grace's words floated back to him.
Forget about me.
It was much too late for that. Mitch realized that in the last 2 months he'd barely thought about Helen. Grace had taken her place in his subconscious, his dreams. Now it was Grace he was letting down, Grace he was failing. Just as he'd failed Helen and Celeste, just as he'd failed his father.
I've disappointed everyone I've ever loved. I let them all down.
Fuck suspension. Fuck towing the line, and fuck giving up. Tomorrow, Mitch would take a flight to Nantucket Island. The truth couldn't wait. Chapter 31. Mitch couldn't understand it.
You have all the money in the world. You can go anywhere you like. Miami Beach, Barbados, Hawaii, Paris. Why the hell would you buy a house in this dump?
Clearly, Lenny Brookstein didn't have the best judgment in the world. He had a beautiful wife who adored him, but had chosen to shack up with an ugly mistress who loathed him. His so-called friends were about as trustworthy as a bunch of used car salesmen. But this took the cake. As far as Mitch could see, Nantucket had nothing to recommend it. With its gray, clapboard houses and rain-swept, desolate beaches, it was the sort of place that could make anyone depressed.
"What do people do here?"
he asked the pharmacist at Congdon's on Main Street, one of the few stores that kept its doors open off-season.
"Some people paint or write."
"Write what? Suicide notes? Leonard Cohen lyrics?"
"Some people fish. It's pretty quiet in March."
This was an understatement. The guest house in Union Street where Mitch was staying was as silent as the grave. The only noise in the evenings was the heavy tick-tick of an antique grandfather clock in the parlor. A couple more weeks of this, and Mitch would end up like the Jack Nicholson character in The Shining. But it wouldn't take 2 weeks. Within 24 hours of his arrival, word went around the island that a strange guy was in town, asking questions about Leonard Brookstein. Instinctively, collectively, the islanders clammed up. Felicia Torres, Grace and Lenny's cook up at the Cliff Road estate, now worked at Company of the Cauldron, the only high-end restaurant that catered to locals outside of the summer months. Mitch went to find her.
"I'm trying to get a clearer picture of the events in the days leading up to the storm, back in the summer of 2009. You were still living at the Brookstein's home at that time."
Silence.
"How long had you been in their employ?"
More silence.
"Look, ma'am, this is not an official investigation, okay? You don't need to be nervous. Did you notice any tension among any of the house guests that particular weekend?"
At first, he thought she had poor English. Then he wondered if she was mute or deaf or both. Whatever it was, Felicia was about as forthcoming as a clam that had swallowed some superglue. Mitch tried the housekeeper, the maid, the gardener. It was always the same story.
"I don't remember. I didn't see anything.
I did my job and went home."
Tomorrow he would head down to the harbor and talk to the fishermen. Some of them must have been out on the water that day, but he didn't hold much hope.
"It's like they're all part of some secret club, like the Masons or something."
But it made no sense. Lenny Brookstein was already dead. What did they think they were protecting him from? Hannah Coffin called to her husband.
"Tristan, come see this."
"In a minute." The Coffins worked at the Wawanette Hotel, a 5-star retreat in one of the quietest, least populated parts of the island. Like all the big hotels, they were closed through the spring months, but kept a skeleton staff to work on maintenance and repairs. Hannah and her husband acted as caretakers, overseeing the off-season staff. It was a job with a lot of downtime, which Tristan Coffin spent tinkering with his Ducati motorbike, and Hannah spent watching daytime television.
"Tristram!"
"I'm busy, honey!" Tristram Coffin sighed.
"Just buy the damn earrings already, or the super-duper potato peeler, or the greatest hits of Neil Diamond, or whatever it is they're selling. You don't need my opinion."
"It's important! Come on in here!"
Reluctantly, he put down his wrench and wandered into the living room of their modest ground-floor apartment. As usual, the television was on.
"Do you remember that guy?"
Hannah pointed at the screen. A man was being interviewed about Maria Preston's murder. The story was getting juicier by the day. It now looked as if the husband had done it, hired a mob hitman to kill his wife because he suspected her of having an affair. Hannah Coffin was particularly interested in the murder because Maria Preston had stayed at the Wawanette once. Tristram studied the man's face.
"He looks familiar."
"He is familiar," said Hannah triumphantly. "Where's that cop staying, the one that's been asking all the questions about Lenny Brookstein?"
"Union Street, why?"
"I'm gonna call him, that's why."
Tristram looked disapproving. "Come on, honey. You don't want to get involved."
"Oh, yes, I do."
Heaving her 200-pound frame up off the couch, Hannah lumbered toward the phone.
"I know where I've seen that guy before. And when?"
"Are you sure?" Mitch felt like pinching himself. If he weren't scared of putting his back out, he'd have picked up Hannah Coffin up in his arms and kissed her.
100%. They checked in here together. It was the day of the storm, him and Maria Preston.
And they stayed...
all afternoon, like I told you. I'll write it down for you, if you like. Make a statement. He was on TV, acting like he hardly knew her, but he knew her all right. Intimately, if you know what I'm saying.
Mitch knew what she was saying. He was due at the harbor in half an hour, but this called for a change of plans. He headed for the airport. Nantucket Airport was a little more than a shed, a simple L-shaped shingle structure with a pitched roof, one half of which was designated departures, and the other half arrivals. As single and twin-engine Cessnas landed, passengers got out and helped the pilot unload luggage onto the tarmac. In the departure lounge, security consisted of a gray-bearded old man named Joe, who glanced at the locals' bags before waving them through with a cheery smile and a, "See you at the Improv Friday night. Baptist Church, don't be late now." Mitch marched up to the desk of Cape Air.
"I'd like to see your passenger records, please. I'm interested in all flights in and out of the island on June 12th, 2009.
The girl at the desk rolled her eyes.
"And you are... police."
"Darlene?" she called over her shoulder. "I got another one here. Wants those June 12th records. Can you take him?"
An old woman in a tweed skirt emerged from the office. She wore her snow-white hair tied back in a neat bun, and a pair of pince-nez glasses perched on the end of her nose like Little Red Riding Hood's grandmother. Mitch looked puzzled.
"Another one? Has someone else been asking to look at your passenger lists?"
"They have indeed. Darlene Winter."
She shook Mitch's big, bear-like hand within her thin, wrinkled one.
"You policemen are like buses. Never there when you need one, then suddenly you all show up at once. Come on back."
Mitch followed Darlene into an office that was as neat and orderly as she was. There was a computer in one corner, but she led him to a desk on the other side of the room. A big brown leather book lay open. It looked like an antique Bible or an enormous visitor's book from some medieval Scottish castle.
"All our records are computerized, of course," Darlene told Mitch. "That's the law, but we like to do things the old-fashioned way around here. We keep a daily logbook of our flights as well, handwritten. I suspect I already know what you're looking for."
She pointed to a familiar name, beautifully rendered in italics and black ink.
"He caught the 6:10 a.m. to Boston, along with five other passengers. Landed at 6:58. Whatever he was doing that day, it looked like he had changed his mind, because at 7:25... She flipped a page. "He boarded an 8-seater right back to the island. This is his landing record right here. June 12th, 8:05 a.m., Flight 27 from Logan, John H. Merrivale.
Mitch ran his finger across the paper.
So, Hannah Coffin wasn't a fantasist. John Merrivale really could have been at the Wawanet that day, shacked up with Maria Preston.
According to Hannah, the pair of them hadn't arrived at the hotel until early afternoon, a full 5 hours until after John got back to the island, after setting up his alibi. More than enough time to sail out to Lenny Brookstein's boat, get aboard, and murder him.
You mentioned someone else had asked to see this, another cop.
That's right. FBI, I think he said he was, but he came off as more of a military man. Very brusque. A little rude, if you must know. He had one of those army haircuts, you know, much too short.
You don't remember his name?
The old woman furrowed her brow.
William,
she said eventually.
William, someone or other, I think it was, went straight to the same page. June 12th, John Merrivale. Is this Mr. Merrivale in some sort of trouble?
Not yet, thought Mitch. Then he thought, who the hell is William?
The guard looked at the mud-spattered sedan and its lone occupant. He'd expected an armored vehicle or even a convoy of some sort, not a middle-aged man in a dirty family car. This guy looks like her dad coming to pick her up after a sleepover. The camp outside Dilwyn in rural Virginia was a top-secret OGA facility. OGA stood for Other Government Agency, which typically meant CIA, although the Dilwyn camp provided a temporary home for a variety of non-military prisoners considered too disruptive or dangerous to be returned to a mainstream correctional facility. Some were terror suspects, others suspected spies. A few were classified as politically sensitive. But none of the inmates at Dilwyn was more sensitive than the one this man had come to see. The prisoner was being transferred to an FBI holding cell in Fairfax. In a sedan, apparently. Papers, please. The gray-haired man handed over his credentials. For a few moments there was a tense pause while the guard leafed through them. But everything was in order as he knew it would be. Okay, go on through. They're expecting you. Grace stood in the center of her 6x8-foot cell. Planting her legs in a wide stance, she stretched out her arms, focusing on her breathing as she lunged forward into Warrior II pose. She'd been at Dilwyn almost 2 weeks, locked for 22 hours a day in a spare, windowless box. With no one to talk to, no human interaction of any kind, yoga had been her salvation. She spent hours going through a series of poses, energizing her body and focusing her mind and breathing, staving off despair.
I'm alive. I'm strong. I won't be in here forever.
But would she?
Hours, days, and nights had already merged into one long, unbroken stretch of nothing. The lights in Grace's cell were permanently set on dim. Meals were pushed through a tray in the door at regular 6-hour intervals, but there was nothing to distinguish breakfast from lunch or lunch from supper.
They're trying to break me, make me crazy so they can lock me up in a mental institution and throw away the key.
It wasn't working. Yet. Between yoga sessions, Grace would lie on her bunk, close her eyes, and try to conjure up an image of Lenny's face. He was the reason she was living, after all, the reason she kept fighting.
At Bedford Hills, and later, when she was on the run, she found it easy to summon his kind, loving features at will. Grace talked to Lenny the way that other people might pray to God. His presence was such a great comfort to her. But here, in this awful, mind-numbing place, she was distressed to find that his image was fading. Suddenly, she could no longer remember the exact sound of his voice or the look in his eyes when he made love to her. He was slipping away. Grace couldn't shake the feeling that once he was totally gone, her sanity would disappear with him. The one face she could conjure, ironically, was Mitch Connors's. A few nights ago, for the first time in many months, she had an erotic dream, one in which Mitch was the lead actor. She woke up feeling embarrassed, guilty even, but talked herself out of it. You can't help what you feel when you're unconscious. Besides, at least it proves I'm alive. I'm still a woman, still a human being. The door of the cell opened. Grace startled. It wasn't time for her daily exercise. The guard said brusquely, "Come with me. You're being transferred." They were the first words anyone had spoken to her in over a week. It took Grace a moment to unearth her voice.
"Where?"
The guard didn't answer. Instead, he slapped handcuffs on her wrists. Grace followed him mutely along a maze of corridors, trying to contain her elation.
"This is it. I'm getting out of here. I knew they couldn't keep me here forever."
She wondered if Mitch Connors had had a hand in her release and was curious as to where they were taking her. Wherever it was, it couldn't be worse than this place. The guard punched a 7-digit code into a heavy metal door. It swung open. Grace followed him outside into a courtyard.
"Hello again, Grace."
Gavin Williams smiled.
"We've a long journey ahead of us. Shall we get going?"
The country roads were rough and rutted. Each bump and jolt tore through Grace's frayed nerves like a razor. Williams was a madman. She thought back to the last two times they met, once at the morgue when he grabbed her like an animal, and once in the infirmary at Bedford. That second time Grace was sure he'd meant harm to her. The feral hatred in his eyes, she would never forget it. Of course, she had been heavily sedated at the time.
"Where are you taking me?"
Without taking his eyes off the road, Gavin Williams took his right hand off the steering wheel and slapped Grace hard across the cheek.
"Do not speak unless I tell you to."
In mute shock, Grace put her free hand up to her throbbing cheek. Her right hand was cuffed to the passenger door. The handcuffs chafed painfully against her wrist. She sat as still as she could, trying not to move against the metal. Gavin Williams began talking, mumbling to himself like a junkie.
"I thought things would be different at the FBI, but of course they weren't. The cancer is everywhere. Ignorance, stupidity. That's why the Lord sent me. He blessed me with the gifts of intelligence, of wisdom. He gave me courage to act."
Grace felt her heart rate quicken.
"I have to get out of here."
Since they left Dilwyn, they seemed to have been driving deeper and deeper into the wilderness. It was a sinister landscape. On either side of the unmade road lay dense thickets of stinking sumac, broken only by an occasional black walnut tree. Darkness was closing in.
Of course Bane trusted him. They all did. He was smarter enough than Bane, smarter than Brookstein, too, but he wasn't smart enough for me.
"I have to engage him, keep him talking until I figure out what to do."
"Who wasn't smart enough?"
Grace braced for another slap,
but this time Williams seemed eager to talk.
Merrivale, of course,
he spat contemptuously.